it type B and a house of type A's?
Good morning. The Joint Committee on Tax Reform will come to order for Thursday, May 25th, 2017. Colleagues, this morning we're continuing our information meeting on the business tax reform discussion. Dr. Warner has some material for us, and then we'll hear some examples of one possible plan, from Dr. Alanak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. We do have material for you in OLIS. We prepared what we call SIM 11, and I'm going to talk about that with you today. We posted that on Tuesday, but didn't get an opportunity to talk about it. So I'll go through that. The other thing we did, kind of at your for you to look through, I asked Daybeck, our school finance economist, to put together a literature review, really based on questions that Representative Hernandez had raised, linking education to productivity in the economy. And as you recall, we ran some simulations saying, well, what happens if productivity responds to public sector spending? So that's kind of a literature review of the links between those. So I'll leave that to you for your reading pleasure. So what I wanted to focus on this morning is what we call SIM 11. And if you look at the revenue impact piece of it, Chris, the summary. So this is, first of all, I want to emphasize that this is not someone's plan. It's reflective of the kinds of simulations we've been running. And really, while it has the hydraulics that the revenue work group worked through, and so you can see how some of those interact. We do have some revenue numbers, static revenue numbers for you to see how much would be raised. But again, this is not some specific plan that's being promoted by someone. It's more to kind of be illustrative. And really, it illustrates four of the key policy levers. The first is the rate threshold. In this example, we have, remember the earlier example we looked at, we had a rate threshold of $1 million. And this bumps that to $3 million. And that does have some revenue consequences, of course, but it also has some very significant consequences on how many taxpayers you have. If you go from $1 to $3 million, you reduce the number of taxpayers affected by the rate by about 11,000. You reduce it from 18,000 to about 7,000. So a very significant change. There's a lot of businesses that would be right around that $1 to $3 million range. So that's a very significant decision for you to make in terms of how the plan is ultimately shaped. The other thing we first introduced, the initial plan had looked at a specific rate, one rate as Ohio does. This plan looks at multiple rates for different industry sectors. So, and you can see the rate schedule that stands out there. There's a 0.85 rate for services. Recall that under the B&O system, the service rate is 1.5%. So it's quite a bit lower than that. But it is, under the B&O system, the average rate's about 0.48, and this would be similar to that for all other things like construction, for example, would fit under the all other category. For the retail trade, it's 0.35, and for wholesale trade, it's 0.25. As you recall, one of the messages we've gotten from our simulation models is that the wholesale sector is one of the most sensitive to this type of tax, the gross receipts type of tax. So that's the rationale. Two rationales behind it. One is those sensitive sectors. The other is to try to minimize the amount of pyramiding. So the other thing that we've introduced here is the notion of a pass-through credit, and this is when you went through the draft on Tuesday, LC 3549, you saw that there was a blank there for a rate for pass-through entities. Of course, the pass-through entities are not paying the corporate income tax now, and what they do is they pass through their income and pay on the personal income tax side. But they would be subject to the cap if they're over the $3 million threshold. So what this credit is designed to do is to reduce that impact on those non-C-Corp entities that are paying some of the cap. And they tend to be the ones that have a large amount of receipts. So that, again, is a policy lever that you can operate with. If that rate gets to 100%, then, of course, you're just not getting any additional revenue from those pass-through entities, and you have a, you're not broadening your base, in effect. So that's, but again, that's a lever you can work with as a policy decision. And finally, the other piece here is one we've talked about, is the personal income tax. And under this plan, it's similar to what you've seen with lowering the marginal rates. One difference here, and it does make a significant difference in terms of revenue, is instead of that third bracket going from 9 to 8.5, this goes from 9 to 8.75. So that doesn't sound like a lot, but it does have a significant revenue implications because there's so many people in that 9% bracket, so much income in that 9% bracket. So you can see the revenue effect there. The just to give you a sense, and Chris is going to go through and give you a lot more detail around the pass-throughs, but if you think about the pass-throughs and how important they are to this, to the CAT, we estimate that they would pay about 25% of the CAT. So the pass-through entities, S corporations, partnerships, and also the sole proprietors that are over the threshold, they pay about 25% of the total CAT. So if you, for example, if you're going to have a 25% credit, so it's 25.25 times 0.25, you reduce revenue by about 6.25%. And so that's what happens here, and that's what you see from that second line there, the 25% CAT impact. So those are the numbers. We'd have the other thing I would mention that we have put in here is the repeal of the pass-through special rate credit that was approved in 2013 special session. And the revenue estimates assume that takes effect with the 2017 tax year. That's why you have a little bit of a bump in 17-19. And then the 19-21, 21-23 numbers, those are actually the exact same estimates that Chris prepared during the special session for that. For those numbers, so we have some evidence from 15, and they seem to be pretty much in line with what we thought revenue would be so far. So that gives you an idea. If you look on the output from the simulation, you can see the impacts. And our simulations, we've run a number of different similar kinds of scenarios, and you know the results are pretty much within a narrow range. And that, of course, always gives us some comfort in terms of our model. We don't want it to be jumping all over the place when we make modest changes. And that's pretty much coming through. If you look at the broad macro measures of the economy, personal income is virtually unchanged, 0.00%. There is a slight drop in the nominal personal income, but you see that employment is up about 4,100. And again, this is what you saw in the earlier simulation we looked at. The employment numbers are sensitive to those rate reductions in the personal income tax, and that's where you're getting those gains. Again, if you look at it, 4,100 is not a big impact. I mean, it's about less than 0.2%. So it's a small impact on employment, but it's positive. And we have consistently got this result from our models going back to when we first created OTIM in the early 2000s, that if you reduce income tax rates or property taxes and impose a destination-based consumption tax, in general, you're going to get employment gains unless you get way out of line in the magnitude of the changes. You can see population, there's very little impact on net migration. There is an increase in investment of $37 million. And what that means is that the economy is becoming more capital intensive, and that means that you have essentially, it's the elimination of the corporate income tax, but it's also the destination-based tax. The destination-based tax benefits your exporters, and you're seeing that in that investment. So you've got businesses that would invest here, that would expand, and then sell outside of Oregon. The return to capital is positive. The price levels are up about 0.15%. So there is an increase in the overall consumer price level, and you see that in terms of the distribution of the tax burden. We do have, when we look at the dynamic revenue impact, it's actually positive because of the slight increase in economic activity. If you look at the distribution of the tax burden, you can see that you do see some impact at the lower end, proportionally more impact there. and that's largely because of the consumer price effects from the CAT is pushing up the price level. On the other hand, you can see that the next sectors, or next groups, 20 to 68,000, see very little economic impact on them. And in fact, when you look at the number of households, there's actually more people in that category as a result of the tax change. And that's because they benefit from those rate reductions. And that's where the employment gains are coming. They're coming in those sectors. You also have a differential in the in the CAT rates, with a lower rate on retail and wholesale trade, and you'll have employment gains in those sectors, and that's what's showing up in employees in those categories. But the main thing is the hydraulics around the income tax. You get the lower rate, the lower marginal rate. The lower marginal rate, as we've described earlier, means that the take-home pay is higher. And if you can think about how we think the labor supply curves work, workers respond more to the lower or to the higher take-home pay, even though their nominal wage before tax wage is lower.
Give me just a moment. Senator Hass?
Sorry for interrupting, Paul. Almost all of the – sometimes this plan is criticized for being, you know, another 97, but almost all of these scenarios we looked at show a positive in the employment in the wage index. What the measure – you did one of these on 97 – mm-hmm. If I recall, wasn't it like a huge negative unemployment, like 40,000? Was that a result of the high rates?
Mr. Co-Chair, no, I wouldn't call them huge effects. I mean, we had impacts of around a minus 18,000. But again, those are small in relative to the economy. So it wasn't a huge negative. It was a negative, though. And the reasons for that, I think the reason for the differences in this is, one, this is... the CAT is a lot lower rate and spread over more sectors, a larger portion of the economy. And also you have the income tax impacts that have a stimulative effect, particularly in the labor market that we're describing. So
does the change in the – does the removal of the corporate income tax make a difference?
Yes.
In this issue?
Yes. Mr. Co-Chair, yeah, removal of corporate income tax has a positive effect. If we just view that by itself, it has a positive effect on employment. So the CAT by itself has a negative effect on employment. So the combination of those is what's giving you the positive effect. So the other change here that is the biggest change in terms of the distribution of the tax burden is from the repeal of the special pass-through rate, which, as you recall, Chris presented to both committees, was very heavily concentrated at the higher end of the income spectrum. So removing that means you have a significant impact on the above 205,000 group. They actually experienced the largest percentage decrease in income and in mean income per household. So they're the most affected, and it's because of that repeal of that special rate that's driving that. That does have some negative effect on employment when you look at it individually without these other changes, but in net you can see that it's a positive in employment because we're using this whole combination of changes, and the model produces a net positive in employment and investment. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stop to see if there's any questions, and if not, then we'll ask Chris to talk about a lot more detail about how the pass-throughs are affected in this policy.
For the example, yes. Questions? It looks to me like we've asked most of the questions already.
Okay.
Another example, I'll simply note that this simulation shows an extremely modest impact on the economy, and it was mostly positive. And yet at the same time reduces results in income that we need to pay for basic services that all Oregonians benefit from.
That's correct, Mr. Co-Chair. And these by the way, these numbers are the what we call the short term, the 5-year term, 5-year period of adjustment. So we haven't adjusted that productivity parameter we talked about last week. So if you do get those kind of productivity gains, and you talked a lot about the step from getting additional revenue to making those gains, implementing them, and that's a big step, obviously. But really, I think beyond the scope of what our model can do. But if that does work toward productivity, then you would get bigger gains than this, as you saw last week.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, Representative Bueller.
Just a point of clarification, Paul. You haven't run any modeling for productivity and return if the disposable household income was remaining in the private sector.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Bueller, yes. I mean, if you keep the current mix in terms of public-private, that's the base forecast. Mm-hmm. So as we've talked about, when we do these simulations, we're not trying to provide an alternative forecast to the state economist projections. We're saying that's the baseline, that's what's happening. And you can interpret the current law forecast that you heard last week as essentially assuming the mix stays the same, the policies stay the same. So he's got productivity gains built in there. Those are driven by national factors, national investment. So all of that is built in. This is what we would see as modifications to that growth path if these policies were undertaken. And frankly, I mean, in terms of these economic impacts, they're pretty minimal in terms of, you know, predominantly what's going to happen to the Oregon economy in the next 5 years is largely going to be driven by what happens in the national economy, what happens to those trends in the private sector, particularly productivity. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't change those. These are just looking at what our model is saying would be modifications to that current law projection.
Thank you. Oh, Representative Benz, did you have a question before?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forgive me for not asking it more quickly. The wage index, can you, under the 2000, you have to go back up on your chart there a bit. What can you explain that again with the negative impact?
Mr. Co-Chairs and Vice Chair Benz. The wage index, that's a nominal wage is what we call it, which means it's the average wage in the economy. And so that is, I mean, we're the implant. This is OTIM is based on an implant platform. So there's a series of markets, labor markets, factor markets that are interacting to generate average wages, average prices. So that's where we start from, and we set that equal to 100. So think of that as the average wage in the economy. So we go into this, and we change our income tax policy. So we lower our rate, particularly for the lower ends that go into that 4.5%, 5.5% marginal rates and the 875. And workers, we're in equilibrium, supply equal demand, and there's the average wage. Now workers see, well, our take-home pay is higher at this wage, whatever it is. If it's, say, $500 a week, now all of a sudden that $500 a week, I'm actually getting more because my income tax rate is less. So what economic theory tells you is the workers are going to say, okay, well, my wage has gone up. My real wage, my take-home pay has gone up. So I'm willing to work more hours, more people join the labor force, and that creates an increase in the supply of labor. As the supply of labor increases, the nominal wage comes down. So employers are saying, hey, the wage rate's going down. I'm going to hire more workers. Workers are saying, my take-home pay is up, so I'm going to be willing to work more hours. So you have a new equilibrium wage that's a little bit lower in terms of dollars and cents terms, but a little bit higher in terms of after-tax wage.
Well,
yeah, please.
Yeah, this is not following up on that question. It's more a question of when the grand bargain was put together, and we'll probably get into this with Chris. We could, with the same types of numbers were crunched and factored into the elements of the grand bargain. So it's going to be very interesting to see if we were to compare the guesses, estimates, analyses we did 4 years ago, how they look in the rearview mirror now as we proceed based upon the foundation established in part by that grand bargain and the decisions we made then. Are we going to get that kind of discussion?
Mr. Vice Chair, we have the first year's worth of data from the special rate and who benefited and how that was distributed. And remember, we've talked about that with the committee. We can go through that again. So, but Chris has data on what industry sectors it came from, what was the distribution in terms of income of the beneficiaries. So we have all of that data. So that's, we factored it, we use that data we have to input it into the model to say, okay, what happens if that all goes away through the repeal? And so that is, that's what we input it into the model, and this is the result.
And to follow up on that, which again is in anticipation of Chris's discussion, but we would want to see not only the benefit that accrued to the individuals who enjoyed the lower rate, but the benefit to the economy that would have been called out 4 years ago in whatever modeling was done then. But perhaps we'll see part of that in a few minutes.
Vice Chair Vince, we didn't actually run the OTIM model on that policy proposal at that time. So we didn't have a model that ran at that time. We have now. I mean, basically, we're looking at what happens with and without, and so we can look at that again. This is a simulation without that rate, but of course, it has those other changes in it too.
If I may, Mr. Chair, it's gradually coming back to me, but it seems to me that the justification for the adjustment in tax rate to pass through at that time was the assertion that there would be more investment in business, and we have seen obviously some pretty astounding growth in business. But how much of that's attributable to that particular decision in this space, we're not going to hear. Is that correct? Are we going to be able to know? The foundation you built this model upon, in part, is driven by decisions made 4 years ago.
Yeah.
The question is, how much of today's enjoyable economy was driven by those decisions?
Vice Chair Benz, I understand your question. It's implicitly built into this, as I said in response to Representative Bueller, that these are adjustments to the current law forecast. And one of the things you recall that the state economist showed you was we did have a big jump in Schedule E income, which is directly affected by that rate. But it's also a time of the business cycle where we would expect a big jump. And we've also had a real estate boom, which we think is driving a lot of that income, which is not affected by this. So basically, it's very hard to disentangle what those impacts are. But again, in terms of the model, we've built in what we thought were those impacts, who was affected based on the year data we have, and then that's what we inputted into the model, and then we removed that. So it was, in effect, a negative impact as a result of that, if you view it alone.
The good news is we get to talk about this more because Chris is going to focus on it.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So before I get into the specific examples, we're talking about a little bit of context. We're getting some general questions about some context for the tax. So I just have a few numbers here related to questions that we've been getting from a few different corners. And those are the dollars involved, the income tax, and the number of entities. So under the current system for the income tax, among C corporations, pass-through entities, and those are the LLCs, S-corps, partnerships, and sole proprietors, we have about $18 billion of income in the current income tax system and about 400,000 entities, 30,000 C corps, 120,000 pass-through entities, which are largely split almost evenly between S-corps and partnerships, and then about 250,000 sole proprietors. So that's under the current system. So moving or implementing a commercial activities tax, the number of entities we're talking about that would be affected by that tax are about 56,000. And this is for this these numbers are a little bit rough because it depends on the exact plan because we've been bouncing around. We have, if the rate applies to sales above a million or 2 million or 3 million or 5 million, but the number of entities here is around 56,000, and most of them would be paying the minimum tax, the $250. That's just the flat. And most of these entities are pulled out because it doesn't apply to those with less than $150,000 of income. And then the ratepayers are about 11,000. Again, that varies depending on the particular plan, so these are just ballpark numbers for contextual purposes. So, and the taxable receipts, as Paul mentioned, about 75% of them are are from C corporations, and 25% of them are from the pass-through entities. The other question we've gotten is the definition, as people are looking at the legislative concept, the bill draft that was shared on Tuesday, that calls out a couple of different sectors for different rates. And what we have in there right now are services and other. What we've been modeling recently, as in the SIM 11, we have service, other, wholesale, and retail. And so the question then becomes, how are those defined? Because they're not currently defined in the bill. But for modeling purposes, they're tied to the NAICS sectors. And that's what we have here. And if people access this document, this is a hyperlink. People can actually go to the website, and they can drill down and figure out what kinds of entities fall where. So we just wanted to share that. But we've also been getting a lot of detailed questions and requests to go into more detail on some of the examples. I've gone through a few of these at a very high level in a very simplified manner. So I apologize for all the numbers on here, but that's kind of the nature of the beast as we get into more detailed examples. So I'm going to try and go slowly through this, but please chime in because the information kind of builds on itself. So what we have here are three kinds of businesses. We have a sole proprietor, a small of the small businesses, an S corporation that's kind of a mid-sized business, and then a partnership that's a large business. So we have the small, medium, and large. And for each of these, basically have three scenarios. There's the current law tax system, and just to set the framework, and then under a 0.5% CAT, and then that same 0.5% CAT with a 25% credit. Again, this is for the pass-through entities. So starting with the sole proprietor, we have a business with $750,000 of Oregon sales. And the plan we're talking about here is a 0.5% CAT that gets applied to Oregon sales above $1 million. So we have a sole proprietor. They're all in-state only. No exports, and their business income is $225,000. Now, regular PIT here, PIT stands for Personal Income Tax System. So this is a Schedule C filer, and all of that income is taxed on the personal side. And the assumption here is this is the only income. I've had to make a number of assumptions. We're talking about a joint filer, and they itemize their deductions, and that's taken from actual tax returns. So, but I keep that stuff fixed. And so for their $225,000 of income under the regular PIT system, the 5, 7, 9, and 9.9% structure, their tax would be just over $18,000. Because they're not a partnership or an S corp, they're not eligible for the pass-through entity rate. So it's not applicable for them. And this is current law, so there's no CAT. Their total income tax under current law is the $18,092. So that's the framework that we're starting from. Now, under a scenario where we implement a 0.5% CAT, their CAT liability would be $250. Okay. Their sales are less than $1 million, so they don't hit the rate. They're paying the minimum tax.
Got it.
So it's $250. And in this case, the assumption here is that this business doesn't change their prices. They just take the hit on their business income. So their business income falls by $250 because it's a deductible expense. So their actual income taxes decline a bit. They go from $1,892 to $18,069. And that's because they have less taxable income. They're not eligible for the pass-through entity. They've paid the CAT of $250, so their total tax is $18,319. So it goes up by a little bit less than the $250 because of the deductibility. Now, if we add in a 25% credit, and the 25% credit may or may not apply to the minimum tax, given the nature of what a minimum tax tends to be, but I have applied it to the minimum tax here for the pass-through entity, so it goes down to $188. That's 75% of the $250. And so the same scenario follows through. Their business income, they just eat this tax, and their business income from current law goes from 225 to 224,813, down by $188 because it's a deductible expense. And then between that, their personal income tax goes to $18,075. So it's all in that range, but it goes up a little bit because the expenses are a little bit less, going from the 250 to the 188. So these are all marginal expenses. And their total tax goes to 18,262. So this is kind of the simplest case, and it's the small case where they're not affected by the rates. So if we move to an S corporation with one shareholder, so this is a business with $15 million in sales, and they do more exporting than they do in-state sales. So they have $15 million of sales, $6 million in Oregon, and $9 million exported. So we have a mix here. They operate at a 5% margin, and so their business income is $750,000. Their regular personal income tax is the just over $60,100. So that's current law. That's the system with the assumptions that I've made. Now, this is a pass-through entity, so they are eligible for the pass-through rates. And that those are rates start at, for the first $250,000, at 7%, and they go from 7.7 to 7.2 to 7.6, and they work their way up to 9.9. So their tax, if they choose to opt into that program, their tax is $54,500. So obviously, and there's no cap because we're talking about current law. Mm-hmm. So they will opt in to the program and pay the $54,000. And so this is the tax reduction. This is a piece of the estimate from the policy that was implemented or adopted in 2013. So if we move on to the interaction with the CAT, we have the 5% CAT, and that 5% is, or a half a percent, is $25,250. Now that half a percent is applied to the $6 million. It's the destination based. Okay. So while the business has $15 million in sales total, the half a percent is applied to the $6 million, and that's the about $25,000. It's not applied to the $9 million that's exported. What I've assumed here moving forward is that this business does have some market ability to pass the tax forward. So of the $25,000 in tax, they increase Oregon sales by about, the prices in Oregon by about $10,000. They're basically dividing this tax increase between the sales that they make in Oregon and exports and themselves. They're able to export about 20% of that tax, and then the remaining they're increasing on their Oregon sales, and they take a hit on their business income. So by increasing
price, just a moment, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, where did that allocation come from that you just shared with us?
I made it up.
I figured that, but where do you think is it just a knowing you? I'm guessing you had some foundation for that. The choice,
Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Vance. Yes, the idea, it's this whole notion of passing on the tax, exporting the tax, or whether or not the business absorbs it. And the OTIM model, what we basically assume there is that exporters are all price takers, so they can't pass on any of that tax. Under some specific circumstances, in reality, a business may be able to export some of that tax by increasing those prices, depending if it's a niche product. You know, if there's some premium value to an Oregon-made product, then they might be able to pass along some of that price. So there isn't any economic theory basis for the distribution I chose. I basically wanted to show one piece of each. So some piece of it, so the first step is I'm the business owner. I now have this $25,000 increase in business costs, which is the tax. I'm going to pass what I can on in the form of higher prices, but I can't pass it all on, so I'm going to have to take a hit on part of it. So I wanted to touch on both of those pieces. And within that, I'm going to increase both my in-state sales, my Oregon sales, my prices, as well as the exports. So basically, okay, for this $25,000 tax, about $10,000 is going to my Oregon customers, 5,000 is going to my non-Oregon customers, and then the other 10,000 shows up on my bottom line. It's really just an example to show how this might play out. There's no theory or defense as to why that particular distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yes, please.
So Ohio,
can we look at Ohio and see what happens there? They seem to be the foundation for the concept.
The actual impact on pricing gets to be a bit tricky. There's a lot of arguments about national pricing and how these prices show up. And when things are actually sold in markets, the way the prices can be affected are myriad. I mean, you can sales prices, there can be special discounts. There are a lot of ways that those can really affect. There's not a tracing of the dollars through the economy, if you will.
And, and for those S corporations, I represent cattle ranches or farmers. They're subject to whatever the market may be. They have no pricing capability. So for them, they can't pass it on. That's your point when you say you sell outside the state, because you're subject to that market. And you're going to get for an onion what you're going to get for an onion regardless of how we tax it.
For example, so in that case, if this were an onion farmer and they couldn't, I lost my cursor here, and they couldn't do that, then this isn't realistic in terms of the $5 million going to the exporters.
Yeah.
They couldn't do that.
Okay.
Excuse me, Senator Hass.
Thank you, Chris or Dr. Warner. I noticed that we seem to be getting some interest and support more from the C corporations on this approach and more resistance to the S corporations. Can you back up a step and try to describe what's going on with our current system and how this would change it, whether it hits them harder than the C corps or we're not hitting them hard enough under the current configuration, or what's the dynamic at play?
Mr. Co-Chair, I'll take first crack at that, and Chris can show some of the examples, particularly how the pastures are affected. I think there's a number of factors at work. Number one, if you look at the overall framework, the C corporations do get relieved of the cost and, of course, the complexity of the state corporate income tax. So that's obviously a plus for them. Even though they're paying 75% of the cap, they get the benefit of having the corporate income tax go away. So that's obviously part of their calculation. You also see, I think, and we've emphasized this, and it shows up here again in Chris's examples, that the C corp, if you're an exporter, and of course not all C corps are exporters and not all non-C corps are not, but you see the larger corporations that are export oriented, their destination-based tax doesn't directly impact them because their markets are overseas or outside of Oregon. So that, I think, is another factor. And then, of course, the third reason I think here is that the way the pass-throughs are structured, they're not paying anything at the entity level currently, other than property taxes, that kind of thing. But they're not paying any specific tax on their activity, and this does impose a tax on their activity if they're over the threshold. And so that, I think, is where you see some of the biggest concerns, is this is a tax now that doesn't exist for them, and it's not substituting for another tax like the C corps are. So I think all those factors weigh in. And of course, the when we talked about this in the revenue work group, this is the rationale for looking at some type of a partial credit to offset some of the impact that the pass-throughs may feel from this without the alleviating effect of another tax going away. But of course, the policy goal here, I think, is, as we've described this and going back to the guiding principles of the business tax reform, was to broaden the base. So the base is being broadened. It's being broadened into these other entity types that are now going to be bearing a higher tax liability as a result of that. So that's where I think you're hearing the concerns.
Representative Nose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, in your modeling up there, do you reveal that some of these entities can deduct these taxes as a business expense on their federal tax return? Am I remembering that correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nose, that is correct. The examples here I've just put together from an Oregon perspective. One piece that is not on here is the deductibility
on the federal taxes. So I've included the deductibility of the higher of this tax. So
you did include it or you didn't include it?
I included it for Oregon, the Oregon deductibility.
But not for the federal.
I did not include the federal deductibility because I didn't get into the federal tax piece of it.
Okay.
Okay, so net taxation is exaggerated.
If
by the fact that if we added in the federal tax would be lower.
There would be correct. There would be a more of a deduction. There's value to the deduction.
Mr. Co-Chair, just going back to Sim 11 that we ran, when we run those simulations, we pull out our estimated federal deductibility. So the simulation you saw did include the anticipation that there would be that federal taxes would go down for those taxpayers, and in effect, the state would export a portion of our taxes to the federal government.
Well, that was on the presentation that you made.
Right, the Sim 11. So right. when any of those simulations, we include that. So any of that, those results you see include that effect.
Could we include that information in future examples?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I mean, that way you get what the real impact on the business is. If you include that information.
Yes, we can. My experience with the examples, it helps to build on them over time, because if we incorporate everything, there's so much detail.
Right.
So, but that is an important point here. This is just the Oregon piece. It's not, federal taxes aren't included in this.
Right.
And we can certainly include that in
but
another
round. If I understand it correctly, and I may not, when the state tax increases, you deduct that as a business expense from your federal income, and therefore federal income taxes decline by some percentage of whatever that amount is.
Correct. If your business expenses increase by $1,000, so say that it's a $1,000 CAT, that's a deductible expense. And so on the personal return, on the federal personal return, they would get their percentage times that $1,000. So if they're in the 25% bracket at the federal level, that $1,000 tax increase, 250 of it is the federal taxes go down by 250. And that's basically what Paul was referring to in the simulation. That's an exporting a portion of that tax. That $250 CAT tax is exported to the feds. And that is accounted for, as Paul was saying, in the simulations. I just haven't gotten to that point in these very specific examples.
Okay, so in the rates that we actually have, most of the examples you're giving us here, those people are in the marginal 35-38% bracket, aren't they, for federal taxes?
They are in the higher tax brackets at the federal level.
And so the dollars involved are quite a bit higher than what you've described for most of these examples.
Right. So that's an important point. The value of the federal deduction is not included on these yet.
Great. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a comment before my question, the reduction that you're discussing is somewhere in the one-third range. I would just remark that the federal tax change discussions include substantial reductions in the rates in return for doing away with deductions, and so relying upon that one-third adjustment that's been discussed over the last few minutes is subject to change. Let me just go to the question here, which has to do with not necessarily with what you've called out on this chart, but it would be the comparison of what you've called out on this chart of a small business as compared to a very large one that has let's just use a hypothetical substantial Oregon sales but massive out of state sales. A C corp, and what I'm noticing in this entire discussion is a bias toward big business and helping big business at the expense of small business, and the only way to call this out would be to look at the C corp situation, which you've alluded to several times, and how they would be benefited if they had substantial Oregon sales, but massive out of state sales, because of course this would completely do away with the income tax on the in-state sales. Goodbye. They would go away. Mm-hmm. And that's the comparative condition of the illustration here on the sub S. It would really be challenging for us to justify such inequity that would be created. wouldn't it? And so before we get away from this entirely, I sure want to see those comparisons between how this would indeed benefit very, very large businesses. I usually use Amazon as the example for Amazon, but still, we need to have that inequity clearly in mind.
Representative Noss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to kind of riff on what Representative Bent said, don't we fix that a little bit by, you know, where the threshold is for it? Is it a million? Is it 3 million? Is it 5 million? You know, as a way to get at the small business piece of this. And then
To look at the overall numbers, Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Noss's comment is right. That's a key policy decision for you, where the threshold is. As I said, you know, you reduce the number proportionally. There's some C-corps in that too, but it'd be proportionally more pass-throughs. But just to look at those round numbers, and you look at the commercial activity tax and the SIM you saw that was estimated to raise about $2.7 billion in 1921. So about 75% of that would come from the C-corps in our estimates. So that would put it at about $2 billion. And then if you look at the elimination of corporate income tax, it's about $1 billion. So the C-corps would be paying, instead of $1 billion, they'll be paying about $2 billion under this plan. So they would, and that's ignoring the federal deductibility, but they would be getting an increase in their significant increase as well.
Representative Noss, I'm going to say this, but I want to be clear for the crowd that I'm not suggesting this, but another way we could get at that is we could do away with the single sales factor, right? We could go back to what we had.
The three factor.
Yeah, and then that changes the mix pretty significantly.
Yes.
And I think there's a good reason for why we're not doing that, but that would be certainly a way to look at it.
All right, Representative Buehler?
Yeah, I'm also concerned, you know, with what you've outlined here, and to follow up on Representative Bent's questions about the distinction and the effects on C&S corporations. And then you have on top of that the fact that S corporations are much less likely to be vertically organized like a C corp in terms of the adverse effects of pyramiding. So this is a big advantage to large vertically integrated corporations versus a small business that has a lot of transactions.
Those are correct points. The direction here was examples to focus on pass-through entities in and of themselves. We can certainly come back and compare S-corps to C-corps. I can certainly work up those examples.
Representative Pence.
I just want to, again, at the risk of making your spreadsheet 6 or 7 miles wide, these large corporations that we're talking about having to pay $2 billion have many times pricing power, and thus we would have to call out before we talk about how that creates equity, how able they are to pass those costs on. So just another column on your chart.
And to that point, prior examples made very simplistic, one-sided assumptions about the pricing, the market power. And here in some of these examples, keep losing the cursor. There it is. Get at putting numbers on assumptions about, so for example here, this particular hypothetical example, they do have some market power. Yeah. It's just a step along that discussion. Points well taken.
I just want to call out the fact that in the discussion of that we must have, if we proceed with this concept of making sure that we adjust appropriately that which flows back to the smaller businesses, because the last thing I would want to be party to is a device that further encourages larger businesses at the expense of small. And so whatever that, when we get to that point in this discussion, it'll be of extreme interest to me how we do that. And simply to say that we're going to use a credit that doesn't even make up for that which we're taking away from them, which is exactly what was reflected on the first presentation this morning, is certainly inadequate. But in any event, I just want to make sure the issue is squarely before us.
Thank you. Representative Senator Hass, please.
Thanks. Two quick comments. I agree with Representative Benz that credit probably needs to be larger. A lot of this problem, though, goes away if the threshold is up to, say, $3 million. I mean, that pretty much cancels out 90% of all businesses in Oregon. And you really make it a strong policy statement, essentially saying, forget about incentives or tax breaks or anything. You're not even in this tax. It's more than 90% of the businesses. And I just really quickly wanted to respond to Rep. Nuss's comment about the single sales factor. And I know you didn't recommend it.
I'm not recommending because I know
and I'm glad you didn't because nobody is contemplating that. That's nitroglycerin and dynamite thrown on.
We could do it that way and to address Representative Benz's concern. That was what I was.
This was a partisan issue in 2003 and before that. It isn't anymore. Yeah. Please go ahead.
Okay. So I think I was at the S Corporation, $15 million in sales. They have some market power. The question, so the CAT gets imposed. It's about $25,000. This particular hypothetical example, this business feels that he or she does have some market power for sales. So the question for the business is, my expenses just went up $25,000. What do I do? And he or she increases the prices for Oregon sales. So their Oregon sales actually go from $6 million to $6,010,000. And their export sales go from $9 million to $9,005,000 because they have a little bit of market power. And then the other $10,000 is taken by the business. It's a hit to the business. So their business income goes from $750,000 down to about $740,000. There are a couple things at play here. There's the other $10,000 in the tax, but there's also the deductibility of that tax. So I haven't separated those. It's all embedded in that one number. So their business income goes down by about $10,000, the net effect of those two processes. And then if they chose the personal income tax system, their tax would be about $59,000. But they are eligible for the pass-through rate, and under that opt-in program, it would be just under $54,000. So they will obviously opt in and pay the $54,000 or the $53,790. They're also paying the $25,250 CAT. They're writing the check for that. Now, they got some of that back from the increased prices here, and they kept the margin the same, so that all factors in. I didn't pull out every piece of the interaction. But that's all embedded in here because the higher sales, keeping the margin fixed, actually increases the business income a hair. Now, at the end of the day, they're paying the $53,790 and the $25,250, so their tax goes to $79,040. And that's the CAT, the check that they write for the CAT, and the check they write for the income taxes, the pass-through entity rate. So that same example now with the 25% credit, it's all of the same assumptions, all of the same calculations. The CAT is just lower. So instead of the $25,000, it's $18,900. So they know that's the net effect of what they're going to have to pay because they know that they are eligible for the 25% credit. So that's incorporated into all of the decisions they make. So it's this $18,900 that they're responding to. Oregon prices go up by $7,500. And the export prices go up $3,788, and the remaining piece is taken by the business. So in this case, their business income goes down to just under $743,000. It's the same calculations as before, just mitigated a little bit because of the 25% credit.
It's the problem of focus.
Under Pitt, it would be $59,400 versus the pass-through entity, $54,000. And in all of these examples, the pass-through entity rate is going to be less, but that's a product of how I constructed the example. The CAT is $18,900, and then their tax, instead of going from $54,500 to $79,000, it goes from $54,000 to $72,900 between the two of them. So the third case takes another step toward complexity where we have a partnership and we have two partners. It's a 75-25 split. So one partner gets 75% and the other partner gets 25%. So this is a partnership that has $50 million in sales, but no exporting. They are entirely domestic. All $50 million in sales are made in Oregon. And they have a 3% margin, so under current law, we're looking at business income of $1.5 million that gets split between the two partners at a 75-25 ratio. So the 75% partner gets $1.1 million, and the 25% partner gets $375,000 of the business income. The regular income taxes are $97,000 and $31,000 as they file their individual returns. These are unrelated people. The pass-through entity rates are $83,000 and $26,000. And so taken together under current law, their income taxes are $110,000. These are two distinct families, if you will, filing different tax returns. So under a 0.5% CAT, the 0.5% times the $50 million in sales is about $245,000 of commercial activities tax. So in this case here, I've assumed that half of that gets passed on in the form of higher prices. Again, it's just picking a number out of the air, trying to get at some of the prices increases and the business absorbing the other half. So the $245,000 is just split evenly. So Oregon sales increase from $50 million to $50,122,000. They maintain their profit margin. So the business income net of everything with the tax is $1,381,054. Split between the two partners, the business income for the 75% partner goes from $1,125,000 down to $1,035,000. And the smaller partner goes from $375,000 to $345,000. The personal income tax calculation is 88 and 28, but the pass-through rates are 76 and 24. So at the end of the day, the taxes are $76,000 for the 75% partner, $24,000 for the 25% partner, and $245,000 for the CAT, a total of $345,000, or nearly $346,000. And then the last piece here is the same setup, but with a 25% credit. So instead of $245,000 for the CAT, it's just under $184,000 for the commercial activities tax. They pass that on again. It's a 50-50 split between higher prices in Oregon and a hit to the bottom line. So under this scenario, the partnership goes from $1.5 million in business income to just over $1.4 million in business income. That gets that same 75-25 split. And they again take advantage of the pass-through entity rate. So instead of paying $90,000 and $29,000, they're paying $78,000 and $24,000. And combined with the CAT, the tax liability is $286,979. And so those are basically the differences. I've toyed with how to put that tax increase in context and comparing the differences. You can also compare the bottom line tax increase to divided by sales to get at a kind of effective tax rate, if you will, those kinds of calculations. Some people, I get some questions on what those are, but I stop right here. As it is, there are a lot of numbers on here, and there's a lot of information to digest. But that's basically the scenario for hypothetical small, medium, and large businesses that are pass-through entities. They are not C corporations, so it doesn't include some of that dynamic.
Great.
And it's just going from a current law to two variations of a 0.5% CAT with and without a 25% credit.
Thank you. A whispered conversation we had up here just a moment ago was that we probably ought to have asked to include some C corp examples in a day. One of the problems with the kind of evaluation we're doing is that if you focus into the detail on something, you lose the other pieces of the conversation for that morning. And if you expand out to the broadest possible level, you lose the details in any one area. So it's a choice for how you go about presenting the data. This obviously is a very useful but incomplete example of the way this tax would actually work.
That, Mr. Chair, that's almost the definition of an example, useful but incomplete. And
Thank you.
Has been the case within every time I've done this, within 5 minutes of talking, it occurs to me, oh, I should have included these things, but it has to be limited in some way, so it's a step process.
Representative Nose.
Okay, so it shows the burden, right, and what an entity would pay, but I think to your point, it doesn't do a comparison of, you know, what these entities are paying in other states, right, relative to the tax burden that they experience for doing business in other states, you know, relative to ours. And then, of course, you know, we're a little divorced from what are we buying with this, right? Like, and that's, I know that's the Ways and Means conversation, but, like, you know, we're getting lost on that part as well. Like, what, you know, in theory, they're going to get hopefully a better school system, you know, fewer poor people who can't go to the doctor, and thus they're in the ER for chronic conditions. I mean, yeah.
If, of course, if we're talking about raising most of $1 billion to pay for basic services, somebody's going to pay that tax. And I think if I understood Paul's comment correctly, most of the add-on would still be paid by corporations. Is that, have I got that? Yeah, Representative Bueller?
No, that's good.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you. Oh, sorry, Representative Benz.
Right, Mr. Chair. Well, the last two remarks remind me of thoughts I've had about the intermingling of discussions of tax policy with discussions of budget. And it is difficult to have a conversation about tax policy and keep it narrowly focused upon tax policy. Because, of course, at the end of the day, the amount raised is driven by how much we need in the budget. But that takes us back to the discussion we had, a really interesting one, which ended far too quickly, regarding our reserve funds and why we would ever save. And that took us right into how much do you need? Mm-hmm. So, of course, I don't blame members of the committee for wandering off into budget-related conversation, but it's not necessarily productive. Unless we're going to expand this committee's discussion to include the broader discussion of savings, budget, and tax, which I'm willing to do. Mm-hmm. But I don't generally come prepared to remark upon it because it's not the focus of what I think this committee should be doing.
And if I could remark on your remarks,
Here we go.
The reality of the way the legislature is set up is that tension applies always. Because this committee is theoretically only dealing with the revenue side, and the Ways and Means Committee is theoretically only dealing with the budget side, and the fact is, it ain't possible to do it that way. You have to be able to, you have to consider all of it at once. Of course, we're never going to get into the details of the budget, for the simple fact that we don't have infinite amounts of time. And they aren't going to get into the details of the revenue side because, for the same reason. But we have no choice, I think, but to acknowledge that they impact each other. I think we're stuck with that.
Here.
Representative Bueller, please.
Just to pile on here at one more level, there's a lot of discussion in Ways and Means about input and certainly here about process, but very little input or discussion about output or what we expect to be produced from this revenue. The assumption from your comments and almost every time we meet and represent NOS, and I certainly respect them, is that we are going to get certain outputs from inputs. I think that is a leap in assumption that we right. are going to see declining class size, we're going to see increased graduation rates, we're going to see longer school days, we're going to see a longer school year. There's no guarantee that we're going to see those types of outputs from this input.
Yeah. Thank you. That's exactly right. I don't think that anybody on the committee or actually in the legislature disagrees with the idea that we want exactly those things that you listed. Whether we get them or not, of course, depends on a lot of things. I can tell you that I'm here because those are exactly the things I want. I wouldn't be here otherwise in the legislature. I wouldn't have spent going on 18 years of my life in this process if that wasn't what I was trying to get. Representative Nose, please.
I'll pass. That's fine. Yeah.
Anything else? Thank you.
I wouldn't say anything about Tuesday.
We are not yet certain whether we're going to meet on Tuesday. We've had Senator Hess and I have been discussing that. Stay tuned. We'll let you know. And with that, committee's adjourned. We'll let you know. And with that, committee's adjourned.